Hello, and welcome to Original Lines. I'm your host, Laura Allen, and today I'll be talking with effects artist Seth Wolfson. Seth is a man of many talents. He's worked in television, film, as a special effects and prosthetics artist, a prop and puppet sculptor, an animatronics engineer, even a forensic sculptor. His latest endeavors include designing and operating one of the most popular and most awesome escape rooms in Seattle, Hourglass Escapes. Hello, Seth, and welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. Yeah, well, thanks for coming.
Thanks for inviting me.
How'd you get started doing all of the things that you do?
When I was a kid, I remember just seeing the movie King Kong, the original, like on, you know, TV, and realized I wanted to make little animatronic, like little stop motion puppets. And there happened to be a movie camp where I grew up in my hometown. So my brother had gone there. So I went there. So I started learning about movies. And at some point I wanted to build a little stop motion puppet. I was like 12 years old. So I found the name of like a guy in New York who made them for movies. And I just called him up and he suggested that I mess around with makeup effects because it's a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. I just went to found a makeup effects supplier in Philadelphia where I grew up in that area and just got a bunch of books and ordered some makeup kits and just practiced and then just slowly met people and started working in the industry at a high school. And yes, that's
really cool. I bet you were really popular with your friends. You were the one who could do the Halloween makeup.
Yeah, all three of them. No, I was actually kind of a loner as a kid. Uh-huh. You know, just like I would hide in my basement and make stuff, and I would do it like just work on quietly by myself, or like, you know, cut school to go make movies with people and stuff like that. But yeah, you know, Halloween, I think in my 20s is when people started mm-hmm. asking me to do stuff for them. And, yeah. You know, for a while, doing things for friends was fun.
Yeah.
Then it got expensive and I stopped doing it for friends.
Yeah, I know how that goes.
Yeah.
So you've done film and television, right? Both? Is that?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. I mean, my career, in a lot of ways, I've kind of gotten out of the makeup effects thing in the past few years in Seattle for different reasons, but I mean, I started out doing like low budget horror films that were like straight to video. Mm-hmm. I think the first straight to video film I did was called Zombie Army. It was literally filmed by everybody involved was in the army except like seven or eight of us. And they had, the army had been hired or asked to decommission Pennhurst Mental Asylum in Pennsylvania, uh-huh. which is kind of like a urban, it's like been on the Ghost Hunter shows and stuff like that. And so we were the first people to actually go in there since they had shut it down. Uh-huh. And they had shut it down, legend says, and I don't know how true it is, because of like patient abuses, which may have very well been true at the time.
Right.
So we went in there, like the army went in. While they were in there clearing it, we were filming this zombie movie.
Oh, wow.
That like one of the sergeant who was charged with clearing it suddenly came up with this idea to make a movie. So we went in there and we filmed this like really fun kind of straight to video zombie movie. And I met a lot of people on that helped me get my career started. So from meeting some people there, I got to do like stuff for commercials and TV. But I mean, I was just the guy helping somebody. I didn't get to do a huge amount of stuff.
Yeah. So what was that like? I've done some of live theater, the technical work. And it's like, it takes over your life. It's like, that's what you do. Is it like that when you're working in film and television, like in the technical?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you like that, you're not allowed to have a life outside of.
No, well.
Basically, you don't have time to have a life.
I think if you're going to be successful, that's what you have to do. Mm-hmm. Back then, there was one school in the country, and that was in Orlando at the time. And it didn't, but it wasn't really the best. It was just a small little school. You know, there was a mail order course that I took that was designed by the guy who basically invented all of modern makeup effects.
Yeah.
This guy, Dick Smith. So the only way to learn was apprentice. And so to do that, you had to like go to phone books and find names of people and call them up. And so it was like you had to let it take over your life, because otherwise you were never going to break into the business, because it was very, very small at the time. Everybody kind of knew each other. There was maybe, you know, 5 or 10 people in New York that were doing stuff, 20 or 30 in Los Angeles probably at the time. I mean, and now you have just thousands of people.
Yeah.
You know, the internet kind of, in a lot of ways, the internet made it easier to get into the business, but also just just totally overfilled it. Yeah. So, you know, now I think people don't let it absorb them as much as they should.
Well, I was having a conversation with a painter friend of mine the other day about, it seems like a lot of people are trying to get away from formal schooling and starting more of these, it's almost more like an apprenticeship thing. It's a non-accredited, it's people that get together, almost cooperative, and form these art schools. And there are more and more of these popping up. And, you know, some of them are just like the non-accredited thing. Like here in Seattle, we have Gage or Shack or the Experimental College, which is also an unaccredited, right? It's like, but follow more along the guild lines, you would say, you know, where you actually get together and you have people who didn't know what they're doing. You have the journeyman people that are teaching the younger people. And it's not so much an academic thing as a praxis, like a technical kind of a thing. She said she thinks that that's the direction that a lot of art ought to go, is more of an apprenticeship type thing where you're, instead of going getting this degree and then you're like stamped and then you have, but.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, for what I did and do, I think it's definitely kind of a different animal. Like the thing that I see now, people trying to get these collectives together, but it's usually, sometimes, and it has been known where it's one person basically using people to do their work for them for their paying jobs. Mm-hmm. So when I was starting, I was really lucky. I met this amazing guy, Mike DeFeo, who, if you look him up, I'm actually looking on your bookshelf. You have the Spectrum books. Mm-hmm. He's got a few of his sculptures and stuff in there. He started out doing makeup effects, and now he's one of the leading computer animation modelers in the world. Mm-hmm. And he was really big on helping people. And like, if he got a paid job, he would pay me, even though I didn't know anything.
Right.
So, and he paid me pretty darn well for the time, actually pretty darn well for now. So I was really lucky there. Now I see a lot of people who are not professionals trying to teach people their techniques in these small makeup collectives or using YouTube videos. And the people aren't really understanding what they're doing. You know, I've taught classes and but when I teach, and I was teaching at the Experimental College, you know, I tell people, hey, this is just to kind of get you into it. And then there's some full schools or go apprentice. I'm just here to kind of give you some of the basics. I'm not, you know, the best artist in the world. I'm just, here's what I know. You know, I was trying to, you know, be as honest about my experience and talent as I could.
Right.
Because I do see people all the time just telling everybody how it should be done. And then I look at it, I'm like, yeah, nobody does it that way, or that's really dangerous. Because they've all just learned from a lot of amateurs. Nobody's stopping to apprentice under like a really good master. They don't read books anymore. That's a huge problem. And then, you know, not to be like the old man, like, oh, you gotta go back to making your own clay. And it's a matter of, there's a lot of books out there written by really, really talented people, mm-hmm. who teach you why you're doing something, not just how to do it.
Like what? What are some examples in case somebody's...
There's a lot of people who will use like some basic like materials, like they'll put latex and cotton all over their face, mm-hmm. To do like, you know, a latex and cotton buildup. It's kind of a makeup that, you know, they would use this in the 40s. In 50s, which looked great on really low quality 16 millimeter film, uh-huh. or, you know, medium format cameras back then. And it's good to understand it and know how to make it look as best as possible. But it's not something you would ever use in a film. So you get a lot of people who learn from YouTube and then they go on these, you know, small movie sets. You know, a lot of times it's just, you know, no budget. They're doing it for free. It's student films. But they're just perpetuating this mediocrity instead of just reading some of the books that are out there. There's some great books like the Monster Makeup Manuals just came out there. It's a kind of a recent book. There's two and a third coming out. And it'll show you how to spend the same amount of money, uh-huh. and just do a professional camera ready job.
Okay.
And it's just, people are just, they've got to get off the YouTube. I sound like an old man, off the YouTube.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's like the good, there's you got good and bad. The YouTube, it's like anything you want to do, if you need to do something, it's like, okay, well, I need to figure out how to install my protein pump or my fish tank. I can get on YouTube and I can find a video.
Yeah.
But that does not make me an expert in,
And there's safety involved with makeup. That's the other thing. I mean, there are some really good Facebook groups like Stuart Gordon, who does the makeup for Doctor Who and a bunch of stuff in Britain. He's got a great Facebook group, and there's a lot of great people. They have videos that they've made, mm-hmm. and they're like, hey, go check this out, or go to this YouTube person, this specific video will help. And there's some really good online courses now from uh-huh. Stan Winston's school and stuff. I think the hardest part, and I don't know, you're as a painter, when you're working with beginners, if you give them something and say, hey, copy this, they'll show you something and it doesn't look anything like it. But in their mind, they see it as a copy. Uh-huh. And I think that's the problem with any art, is learning how to see what you're doing and actually look at what you've done compared to what you're trying to emulate and filling in that disconnect.
Yeah.
You know, because I see it, you know, once you teach somebody how to fill in that disconnect, they can go from a very beginner sculptor, in my case, to an amazing sculptor that'll surpass anyone I've ever seen. And that yeah. happens. It's just, you got to just find that switch and flip it for him.
Yeah.
So
is it like greater levels of kind of discrimination? Like you can see more and more of the problem or what you didn't do. Is that kind of a level thing?
Yeah, it's experience. Uh-huh. I mean, like I can look at a makeup, and even if it's something I don't know how to do, I can figure out, okay, it's this material. But when I was like this weird makeup nerd when I was growing up, I would watch a movie or get one of the horror magazines, and I'd list the materials I thought they would use and then write out how I would do it. Like, okay, I would, you know, use this material to do this. And I would basically almost budget a job before I knew what budgeting a job was.
Wow.
Just so I could understand it. Mm-hmm. And then I would talk to some of the people. Sometimes they just call the person up who made it. Mm-hmm. I mean, back then it was easier because there wasn't a lot of people calling these makeup artists, you know, idolizing yeah. them. And I was like this 12-year-old kid. So they would hear a little kid's voice and, you know,
be like, oh, I yeah. talk to him. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, I think people, you know, I don't know. It's just they seem to try to take the quick, easy way mm-hmm. out as opposed to just taking a little bit of time and doing some real research. But, yeah. you know.
So teaching. So we're sitting here talking about teaching. Where have you taught? You've taught here in Seattle, right? At Experimental College.
Yeah. Experimental College. A friend of mine, Nils Osmar, he started this company, I guess it would be called Classrooms and Workshops. And mm-hmm. they teach everything from website building to how to do your taxes to art. He actually teaches a lot of the film and art classes. He's a really, really talented. He's an amazing director. I've worked with him a few times, and he's really great to work with, and he's a really good artist. And so he teaches these small little workshops. They're like, you know, a couple bucks, you know, $100, $200,
right.
you know, materials are not that expensive. And it's just like, you know, anything from a 1-day workshop to a 6-week class. And it's great for like, if you've never done anything before or you want to brush up on your skills, it's just a lot of fun. They're really, you know, they're not expensive. So, like, it's great for something to do. Like, mm-hmm. I was looking at editing classes, and that's how I found him, and I approached him about doing makeup. And one of my first big, like, adult jobs, I was teaching makeup effects at Art Institute of Philadelphia when I was 20. Uh-huh. So I taught in New York for a couple years in New York City at a beauty school, mm-hmm. of all places. I taught makeup effects. A couple places in Orlando, and then here I did it for about a year and just got kind of burned out.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get students. I mean, it's hard to find students. It's a lot of work just to advertise.
Right.
You know, it was a lot of fun, and I made a lot of really good friends and a lot of good connections, but I just needed a break, so that's when I decided to open up an escape room and have no time, free time. I don't know, that break, the break never happened.
Well, okay. Well, that seems like a good place. Let's take a quick break.
Sure.
And then we'll come back and I'd like to talk to you about your escape room. Hey there. Do you know that you can find Original Lines on both iTunes and Stitcher? So whether you have an iPhone or Android, you can always catch the latest episode. Be sure to subscribe to us, and please, we love reviews. Thanks. Hello, we're back with Seth Wilson. So, Hourglass Escapes, how in the world did you decide to start your own escape room?
Well, I guess it's been 2 years at this point. I went with some friends and did an escape room here in Seattle, and it was a lot of fun. It was the first one I had done, and it was a good first escape room for someone to play, but it was not I felt like I could do a better job. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that they were bad. It was a lot of fun, and it's a good room. And I have experience. So I guess this goes back to my background is for 9 years, 8 years, I was a scenic and animatronic artist at Universal Studios in Orlando. So I'm really good at prop building. My day job right now is I sculpt and make fake body parts for surgical simulation. So I'm basically been a full-time mold maker for 10 years, mm-hmm. Going on 11 years at my current day job. So I'm like, I thought escape rooms were the future. Mm-hmm. And I came up with an idea to make a mobile game where we bring it to people's houses. Because I'm like, okay, what can we do different?
Right.
So I designed this sarcophagus with Egyptian magic. That's I don't want to ruin anything. And I started designing this game. My friend Alex Barbieri, who's a board game designer who also knows Laura,
yep.
He designed the game Damage Report, which is a really fun game. You should go out and buy it and play it. And then I had some help from my other friend in the board game group, Sean. We started designing this game. Then I approached some investors, and my ex-wife said she wanted to invest. When she heard my idea, she's like, you know, well, if you think it'll be good, let's do a business plan. And she offered to be my business partner. So we decided, we built everything and very quickly realized if we brought this anywhere, it could easily break and we'd be out of business. So we decided not to make it mobile. And we found a small little building down in Dexter Avenue on South Lake Union. And we moved in, we set up shop, and people really liked it. Mm-hmm. It's like, we have friends who own other escape rooms, and they came through, and they're really particular, and they really gave us some really good feedback and helped us. They send, you know, there's a lot of good camaraderie in the escape room business here in Seattle, and, you know, we send people to each other. And then that building, nobody knows that, knew this, but we did. It was getting torn down in at the end of this year in 2017, which is, so rent was super cheap, which is why we moved in there. And then we did well enough that we moved to our new location at Northwest Workloss, which is, it's beautiful. It's mm-hmm. about 1,500 square feet. We have this, the game that we started with is called Rise of the Mad Pharaoh. We wanted to go with the campy pulp novel style, you know, art, and it's, we have Dr. Jebediah Carter, the great-great-great-grandson of Randolph Carter, who most people don't know, but a few people have caught on, is who discovered King Tut's tomb.
Yeah.
So we make all these. There's a lot of little hidden Easter eggs. There's some new things that we threw in. Now that we're in a bigger space, we actually added a bunch of puzzles because we want to scale. We scale the game to the amount of players, which is, I don't know of any actually escape rooms in Seattle that do this. And there might be. But what we do is we have a regular mode, we do expert mode. We try to scale the game. So we added some puzzles when we moved into this new space. And there's one Easter egg that is my favorite that you'll have to come and check out.
Yeah,
if you're
I've played it before they moved, but I have not played it since they moved. So I get to play it again.
Yeah. So we're actually adding more puzzles now because it used to be a 9-player game, which is a really odd number. And now it's 14. And then we've had a couple 16-player groups in, which is tight, but now people have said that they think we should do 16 players. Like, customers have said it was fun. So we're adding puzzles and offering that. And then if it gets a little cramped, we'll remove it. But anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I decided I wanted to do it. And we came up with this. And it's going pretty well. And now we have a mobile game that is mobile. It's
a pirate theme, right?
Yeah, that one's called Tales of the Ghostly Galleon. Again, uh-huh. It's very... this one is very campy, even more campy and pun-filled, but it's still the whole idea of, like, just that pulp fiction kind of, you know, artwork for it. I really, like, you know, wanted something kind of with a fun style. So
yeah.
It's just a really goofy game. That one centers around Jacques Cousteau and the Banshee Buccaneer, and it's really interesting because people see these small little pirate chests. Well, they're not even that small, but they think it's going to be a 10-minute game. And uh-huh. then suddenly they realize they're lucky if they finish it in the hour because it's we've hidden all the... There's like secret compartments and all kinds of hidden little things.
Awesome.
And yeah, because you haven't played that one.
I have not played that. My husband and I were... Phil and I were in on the... When you were testing, like the beginning testing, we kind of saw a little bit, but we didn't have to actually play the full game. But
yeah.
That seems like that would be so much fun to get to design and then work on and make it look like what you want it to look like from the ground up. Like working with the other special effects for someone else's idea, that'd be fun. But this seems like it would be so much more fun.
It is. It's
Like, the whole thing is yours.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's all mine, because I've had help. Even on the pirate game, I had a couple friends help. My friend Joaquin and my friend Alan helped. But also the customers help. And this is the thing for any good escape room and any successful escape room. And I'm probably the least experienced in a lot of ways. But you've got to learn to put aside your ego and recognize when it's somebody else's ego when they give you advice. Mm-hmm. So we, like today, I'm actually changing something in the Pharaoh game because there's something that's an issue that is a little bit different in our new space. So I've recognized it, even though I don't think personally it's an issue, other people do. So I've got to just fix it,
right?
Whether I like it or not. The original Pharaoh game actually had 3 possible endings. Nobody's ever seen the alternate ending. And that's where you could actually help the mad Pharaoh take over the world. And
I didn't know I could help.
It's a secret. Well, we had to cut the video off. We beta tested that. And within the first 3 groups, it was too confusing. And I had to throw away a lot of work.
Just
went into the trash. Just said, okay, this video doesn't work. I had to cut the video out, change the story, rewrite a bunch of things because it didn't work. Even though I loved it and the idea was great, at least I think it was great, it was confusing. The pirate game, same thing. I mean, I'm probably going to change some stuff. You constantly have to adapt your game to customers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you may get feedback from one person telling you that the puzzle doesn't make sense, but if everybody else understands it, it's just them. They had a hard time with it,
right?
And that's their ego. But if 3 or 4 people say that there's a problem with the puzzle, there's a problem with the puzzle. It's
right.
My ego. So when I beta test, my rule is 1 complaint, unless it's something that's really obvious that I just missed, I just put it aside and I, you know, store that in my mind. But if I get 2 or 3 people saying the same thing, then that's a problem. And it doesn't matter if I love it.
Right.
It means I need to step back, figure out how to fix it for them.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing with escape room design and what I think is fun is I am not designing it for people who love escape rooms. I know it sounds weird and counterintuitive. I am designing it for people who I want to fall in love with escape rooms. So every puzzle needs to be solvable by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
There are some rooms that really do more puzzly things, and they're for people that are obsessed with puzzles. And ours is definitely on the medium, light to medium difficulty side, and we have some ways around that. But I need some, as a designer and an owner, I want it to be for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
When people say they're bad at math or they hate math, I want them to be able to find our math puzzle, do it, and go, oh, that was kind of fun, and not feel like it was homework.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we try to make every puzzle a different type of puzzle. That's another thing. As you do escape rooms, there's some rooms do that really well. Some rooms, you know, it's 500 keyed locks and you have to go through a pile of keys. It's just ridiculous, you know? But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lot of fun. Just the designing of the room and the decoration and paint schemes and rugs and just like all these little details. And then you put all this stuff in and realize, oh, that's a red herring. I got to remove that. Oh, that mm-hmm. color makes people think this for some weird reason. I don't know why. I got to change the color of that. Oh, this is too short. This is too tall. This is somebody just ripped out of the wall because it wasn't screwed down properly.
Yep.
It's nuts.
It seems like it would be the way you're describing it is perfect. It's like perfect. It's like this work in progress. You're constantly adjusting. But like integrating the story with the puzzles, is that a different type of challenge? I mean,
yeah.
Like you know what I mean? Like trying to work back and forth with puzzle story, make them make sense.
Yeah. There's like, I would say there's, so you've got a couple things that people want out of an escape room. They want story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some people want story. Some people don't care. Some people want quality of atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Some people want quality of puzzles. Everybody wants things to be fun. You've got to go, like, if something is, you're going to make something more fun, but less historically accurate,
mm-hmm.
go for fun. And people will argue this, but at the end of the day, if people had fun, they will forgive something if it's a little inaccurate. But if it's really accurate, but it's boring or dry or like homework, people aren't going to be happy.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to be something that bothered them. So like in our Rise of the Mad Pharaoh room, the story is told through the video when you talk to him. I mean, sorry, the live satellite uplink when you talk to him. But also, we have a rules video that explains some of it. And everybody, we do something, again, we do something I think is different than any escape room. I've never heard of anyone doing what this particular thing. Because I'm a board game nerd, I like that people in board games sometimes are given characters. Mm-hmm. And characters have special powers. A lot of board games do this. So we give everybody a character that they play. My favorite is the Cultist of Bastet. They love cats. They know everything about the cat goddess Bastet. And then there's a clue in the game that you need this clue to win the game. You can't win the game without using the information on this tag. But so now you as a player, you're given this, you put it around your neck. It's got a flashlight in case you need a flashlight. And you have something that's for you to be the lead on. You still need your help of your teammates. And some people's character roles work with other people's. Like you have to combine them and stuff. But it's, we found that this is a way to really perpetuate the story. But also to get new people and new players into how to play an escape room. And then on the back, we have player tips, which is another good thing. And you have this with you. So you're walking around and go, I don't know. And you can look and there's like, oh, this suggests this. So maybe I'll try that. So that's where the story comes in. But then we have visual things about the stories. Like you'll find newspapers. But then there's things like there's a particular painting that's part of a story. And that works with these other puzzles that and other items that you find that actually complete a bit of a story. And then our pirate game, the entire thing is story-based, which is a lot of fun because that one you're trying to figure out which of these 10 wanted posters is the real Banshee Buccaneer's true name. And then you're trying to figure out the name of their true love. And then there's the video. So everything intertwines and it's the puzzles tell a pretty complete story of this love affair. And but it's not dry. It's really fun and it's goofy and pun-filled. You get pirate hats, tattoos. We now have stickers that we give to people after they play the rooms. The pirate one, I think the story is part of the game. And a lot of people who like story like it, but then it has the other stuff that other people like. So
Well, I read an article the other day on Electric Literature, I believe it was. It was a really good in-depth article about how role-playing, like actual tabletop role-playing games, will improve fiction writers. It's actually a really good way to improve your storytelling, improve your ability to, and plus it's just a lot of fun for people who like to write stories. And I think with the board gaming and the tabletop gaming and everything, this is just, it's more of an interactive story. It's like reading or like involved, like a film or whatever, except you're involved in it. You're actually involved in enacting the story and figuring things out. And it's just that extra level of fun that it's the same kind of fun I get like in a role-playing game, except with puzzles.
Yeah. And that's how I describe it to people. It's really hard to describe an escape room, even as an owner. And it's something on the owners groups we always joke about. I describe it, it's like being inside a movie or in your favorite mystery novel. You're the character. You're not watching a performance. You are this character that, whether it's just you off the street, I think a good game has you as a, puts you in a specific role. But it, I mean, you're dealing with these mysteries and they're tangible, they're tactile. There's props. And so it's actual adventure is how I feel. And that's why I like escape rooms. It's, you know, I don't drink. So for me to like, I want something that I can go and that's fun and exciting. And like, it's a really good activity for families. Well, I think we might actually be the only ones who let kids in, like 12 and up, but kids do amazing. That's the other thing is people think that they're going to come in and they're like, I'm an executive. I'm going to be the smartest person in the room. You put an 11-year-old versus them. The 11-year-old is going to just pass them in minutes. I've seen it's hilarious because kids have, they're not afraid to try stuff, you know? But yeah, I mean, it's like, why go to see a show when you can be part of one? Yeah. I mean, we call our events shows because it's a show. We call our players adventures because they're there to have an adventure for the day. It's one of the few activities that I think we get a lot of good feedback. And I think there's not a lot of activities where it really creates a good memory. You know, and I think that's my personal appeal to escape rooms is I have memories of them. And it's like something I talk about, you know, you can have aha moments or eureka moments and it's, there's adrenaline rushes and disappointment if you lose. And I lose a lot at escape rooms. I'm actually a horrible player. Yeah.
I've done escape rooms with you. You're not that horrible. Well, let me ask you one more thing, and then we'll get close to finishing up here. You have right now for it's close to Halloween, and you guys are doing a murder mystery. Is that correct?
Yes. So I'm really excited about this. Yeah. It's called Going, Going, Gone, and it is called that because it is. So as I was saying, our Rise of the Mad Pharaoh room, you're given a character. Mm-hmm. So those are the same characters that you're given in this murder mystery. It's a full interactive murder mystery. So as a player, you have to solve it. You're not watching actors solve it. Like in some of the, it's not like a murder mystery dinner theater. Mm-hmm. You're actually part of it. It's more like a murder mystery party. Uh-huh. So it is a murder mystery and it's the full Rise of the Mad Pharaoh escape room. And it all surrounds an auction, a silent auction that is to benefit the charity Mary's Place, which the auction is real. The charity is a really awesome
charity. But the murder hopefully is not.
You know, I can neither confirm nor
deny. Okay,
So basically everybody's been invited to Dr. Carter's office to see his discoveries. And he's holding an auction of some of these items. And something happens. You have to go do the escape room, which is the full game. And we're actually adding puzzles for people who've played it, especially at our old location. If you've played at our old location, mm-hmm. there's like four or five main puzzles that are new. And then you have to solve the murder. Mm-hmm. And then you finish your silent auction, which is where we're trying to raise some money. So we've got... and the best part is a very, very good friend of mine, Andrea Hayes from Twin Peaks, who played Heidi in the TV show, both series... And one of the movies is our guest actress.
Awesome.
So she's a super, super amazing woman and she's coming to help us out. So, and then we got some cool prizes. Like, so we work our portable Ghostly Galleon game. You can actually play it on Argosy cruises. Like if your company rents out an Argosy cruise, you can actually rent our game out. So they've donated some tickets. We've got tickets from, I think it's the Mopop. I think we got those. We're actually auctioning off full games of both our games. It's just going to be a lot of fun. We're mm-hmm. doing two shows. We're doing a noon and a 3 p.m., a noon to 3 and a 5 to 8 p.m. show on October 29th, Sunday, October 29th. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you're interested, go to our website, hourglassescapes.com. But it's going to be a lot of fun. It's for a really good cause. Mm-hmm. Every month we do a different charity. We always donate, so SCCA, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, they have tickets that they give their patients and they do a patient lottery, but we offer escape rooms for any of the patients who want to come because like if their families are in town, it gets super, super depressing being laid up with that kind of stuff. I have my experience with it.
Yeah.
Last month we did Life Center Northwest because on the anniversary of my liver transplant. And I think for Christmas, we'll do something else with Seattle Cancer Care, like a big fundraiser. So
cool.
Anyone listening has any good charities that they are as a favorite, email us. We're always looking to donate auction tickets to silent auctions and stuff like that to help out.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess you've told us about your website. Where else can we find out more about you?
Hourglassescapes.com is good. For my makeup effects, makeupeffectsartist.com, the letters FX is how it's spelled. And that's like most of my makeup and prop work and my resume and stuff. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming today, Seth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great.
This is fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess that's it for today's episode of Original Lines. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And thanks, Seth, for being here. And you can find out more about us and the podcast at www.twoponiespress.com or subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or any of your other favorite podcast services. Be sure to like and subscribe. Until next time.